Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What role does blood play in human health, identity, and ancestry? Scientists have solved many of the age-old mysteries as to the composition and the function of the blood in our bodies, but that knowledge has done little to diminish the social and emotional importance we attach to this remarkable fluid. Our speech is still peppered with references to it, so that we still speak of blood relatives and bleeding hearts. We chalk up both our strengths and our weaknesses to what is in our blood. And of course, there is the long and often problematic relationship between blood and our notions of race, class, and culture. Author Lawrence Hill explores all of these themes in his new book, Blood, The Stuff of Life. Lawrence, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to join you on Think.
You say that you have had a lifelong obsession with blood. Can you talk about where that comes from?
Well, sure. Some of it comes from personal experiences that I had as a child. I spilled a lot of blood in some rather dramatic moments as a young child, once indeed bleeding profusely, and even in my terror, I managed to make sure that I spilled blood onto every panel of the sidewalk between the site of the accident and my home, as I wanted to sort of mark the sidewalk with this sacred fluid that was pouring out of me. I've had a few other intersections with blood personally, some transfusions one time when I was very ill and working as a volunteer in West Africa, injecting insulin daily as a diabetic, so I've come to monitor my own blood glucose. So for various personal reasons, I've become quite interested in my own blood. But that has led me to think more broadly about blood as a metaphor for identity.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting to think about human culture and society and identity through the lens of blood, in that it is common to every one of us. There's really no difference between, I mean, there's blood type differences, but basically it's the same stuff. And yet it's so often used to symbolize these artificial divisions that we've created among ourselves.
Absolutely. Well, in no instance is blood sort of more crystallized into an artificial barrier between people than when it comes to race. I mean, we talk about individuals as if their so-called race could be boiled down to blood parts. And how many times have we all heard people say something like, oh, I have this friend who's a quarter Korean and a quarter Japanese and half black, as if such things could be lodged in the red corpuscles or in the white blood cells. And it really does lead to thinking, not just sort of ambiguous or theoretical on the part of individuals, but legislatures and assemblies and state houses and in Canada parliaments, in courts, rule and have many times ruled on issues of racial identity, forcing identities on people or denying them their identities based on calculations, sort of arithmetic calculations of their blood parts or blood quantum. So it can get pretty horrifying when formal institutions weigh in on matters of blood and identity.
Did you realize the moment that you started to think about all this for purposes of creating a book, and I understand you did a series of lectures as well, you could have simply talked about race, but we've sort of been through those conversations so many times. Is there something about blood that you thought, this will allow me to unlock something that hasn't been in the public sphere before?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are so many ways to think about how blood sort of sits in our psyches, and many of those ways are subconscious. We're not fully aware of how much it influences us. You began, of course, your introductory comments to the interview today by mentioning some of the ways that blood crops into language, and indeed, you'd be hard-pressed to have a long conversation with a friend over coffee and not have blood metaphors, you know, creep into your speech, usually, you know, subconsciously, whether you're calling somebody a cold-blooded murderer because their blood is, they're so evil that you're likening their blood to that of a reptile, or if you have blood on your hands, or you're speaking about somebody else you've read about in the news who has blood on their hands, maybe some despot or dictator, that suggests they've done something wrong and they'll eventually be caught. We talk about how hard it is to get money back from the tax collectors, kind of like getting blood from stone. You can have bad blood in your family, and there's so many ways that you can refer to people negatively according to the idea that their family has bad blood, and then it goes on and on. I won't sort of weigh you down with too many metaphors, but it totally permeates our speech. But from speech, of course, it permeates other aspects of social discourse, and we can get into some of those too if you'd like to.
Well, let's go back for a minute. Talk about how early healers and philosophers tried to understand blood and what made it so important. They knew that we needed this stuff, but for a long time they couldn't quite figure out what it did.
That's so interesting, and it's, when you think about it, one of the longest medical traditions that we've had, that really dated back a full 2,000 years, was the idea that the body was comprised of humors. A humor is another way of referring to a body part, you know, an aspect of your whole being, a physical aspect. And your whole being was divided into four parts or humors. For thousands of years, we thought about this. And one of the humors was called black bile. Another was yellow bile. Another was phlegm. And the final humor was blood. And the whole notion of health resided in the idea of a balance between these humors. And for thousands of years, if you were ill or if you were injured, and a so-called doctor, you know, wanted to restore you to health, the idea was that the humors are out of balance and you probably had too much blood. You had a surplus of blood, so you should let some out. So for thousands of years, we practiced bloodletting, killing thousands of people along the way in order to restore what we imagined to be a balance between the four key humors, and in order to diminish what we thought was an excess of blood in the body.
You know, it's almost painful to think about that, if you have any empathy whatsoever, to think about people who were already quite ill suddenly being deprived of, you know, ounces and ounces of the blood that was keeping them alive.
Yes. Well, George Washington himself is said to have died of bloodletting. The day before he died, he fell ill with a cold, and a huge amount of blood was let from his body, you know, and he promptly died. And there are many other famous figures, you know, who died of bloodletting, kings of England and the like. Even Napoleon playfully, he survived the bloodletting and described medicine as the science of murderers. And so, but we don't have to look to figures who were famous or who were presidents or famous kings or queens. All sorts of ordinary people, I'm sure tens of thousands have died over the years as a result of this insane, now looking back, seems insane idea to bloodlet, and to bloodlet very vigorously.
And yet the earliest humans must have understood that losing blood was dangerous because they would get hurt in hunting, they would have accidents, they would fight with each other, and I would imagine die of blood loss.
Well, yes, I think that each animal, you know, any sort of halfway intelligent mammal, and certainly human beings, are aware, you know, that losing blood indiscriminately or losing it in an accident or at war or in battle is dangerous. But we still bloodlet in what we thought were controlled circumstances to restore, you know, the humors of our body. We still practice bloodletting. And also we practice human sacrifice. And in many, many different cultures across many different geographies in times, have believed that in order to placate the gods and to win the right to have the sun rise and fall and to have rain fall and for crops to grow and for us to be taken care of, it was necessary to sacrifice human beings, often those very close to you, like your first son or something like that. The whole notion of Abraham and Isaac really signifies in the Old Testament the first time, apparently, that God is telling people, you do not have to do this anymore. You do not have to sacrifice your firstborn sons anymore. You know, apparently, God tests Abraham and sends him up the mountain to slay his son as a sign of faith to God. And Abraham, you know, is stopped at the last minute by an angel who intervenes. And this is supposed to signify that we no longer have to do this. So we also spilled blood, you know, of those we loved in order to gain the favor of God. That's in many, many different cultures and beliefs.
This is worth discussing as well. In the pre-scientific era, blood was used to justify the belief in the superiority of men over women. People felt like every month there was evidence of the fact that men were stronger and fitter.
Absolutely. Well, even Aristotle believed and wrote definitively. You can find him quoted on this matter. I quoted him in Blood, the Stuff of Life, believed that women were inferior to men because they bled monthly. And why did women bleed monthly? Well, according to Aristotle, their bodies lacked sufficient heat to transform blood into semen. And because women were unable to transform their blood or concoct it, as he said, into semen, they therefore had to expel it once monthly. Just where on earth he came up with this theory, who knows? But this is what Aristotle believed, and he believed that women were thus inferior. And many, many other famous, you know, Greek and Roman male philosophers came up with a litany of theories to try to explain women's blood. And down the line, it seemed that every male philosopher in ancient Greece and Rome got it completely wrong. And of course, these theories have profoundly influenced, you know, the way that women have been perceived over time, and the limitations to their rights and liberties and working opportunities. And it'd be a mistake, of course, I think, that this is over. Still, I think women in many cultures and places and times are judged because of the very act of their bodies monthly.
And then, you know, expanding on this idea of blood being clean or unclean, there is, you know, obviously there was concern, particularly when we first started to discover HIV and AIDS and didn't fully understand how they worked. But then there was a sort of labeling of some people as somehow unclean if they were infected with this virus.
Absolutely. Blood is this kind of miraculously flexible liquid in our minds. And on one hand, of course, it's our savior. We all know that we need blood, you know, a good 5 liters of it pumping once a minute through our entire body systems, circulating once a minute through our veins and arteries. We need it to stay alive. And if you lose enough of it, you'll die. We also think that it's quite sacred. And unlike just about any other gift, you know, we can give blood usually without being paid for it. You can give it over and over. I've spoken to one woman who's a very old woman now who gave blood, gave plasma over 1,000 times in her life to help people who needed her plasma very much. So we can give blood. And therefore, you know, blood is, in our eyes, sacred. We don't have a relationship with blood that we have, say, with our toes or fingernails or our kidneys or livers. We have this deep psychic connection to our blood and everything it represents. And I think it represents something sacred because it's a life force that we can give to each other, unlike most other body parts. We can give it regularly and not suffer. On the other hand, just as blood can save us, blood can betray us. And if you had the misfortune to be a hemophiliac during the 1980s and you were the victim of the tainted blood scandals that rocked the United States and Canada and France and Japan and many other developed nations of the world, you might have been transfused with tainted blood that had, you know, AIDS or HIV virus in it, and you might well have died or have been permanently crippled as a result of getting hepatitis C or something like that. So many people have suffered as a result of improper blood transfusions, or transfusing blood that was not safe, that had diseases in it, that was not detected. And of course, this rose to the apex in the early 1980s, before we fully understood even how AIDS was transmitted or what it was, or that there was such a thing as the HIV virus. And so these diseases, especially diseases of the late 20th century, have vastly heightened our fear and paranoia about blood. So on one hand, we venerate it and we know that it can save us. And on the other hand, we're terrified of it. And of course, now you couldn't go into a dentist's office without a dentist naturally wearing latex before sort of probing your teeth. And people are very, very concerned about blood-borne viruses.
My guest is author Lawrence Hill. His new book is called Blood, The Stuff of Life. If you would like to join this conversation, you can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org or tweet me at Chris Boyd Think. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Lawrence Hill. His new book is called Blood, The Stuff of Life. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Lawrence, as the son of a black father and a white mother, can you talk about how blood figured into your sense of who you were and what that meant to you and the rest of the world in your childhood, but also on through your adulthood?
Well, of course, as I mentioned earlier, blood is often seen to be, you know, the fluid that denotes or that holds or that contains your race or your racial parts. And people often remark about your blood as if it really could be divided into parts, you know, this part white and this part black, which really perhaps might seem innocent if it's just a casual thought, but which can be very dangerous when people are truly trying to impose an identity on you, a government or, you know, a perpetrator of genocide or something like that. In my case, I guess the ultimate test of my sense of self came as a young man when I went to work in a very poor country in West Africa called Niger, a French-speaking country, as a volunteer with Canadian Crossroads International as a young man. And while I was there, I grew very ill. I contracted gastroenteritis and became very anemic, and so I had to be hospitalized, and I nearly died, and I needed several blood transfusions to stay alive. And somehow, in arriving in the country, I'd worried, would people see the blackness in me, would my identity and the blackness in my so-called blood be recognized by people from Niger? Would I be welcomed home to Africa as a long-lost sort of brother after growing up in a white suburb in Toronto, Canada? But these worries sort of vanished as I saw these blood bags dripping into my veins, and as my life was saved, I no longer felt it necessary to worry about who I was or, you know, how my blood was composed. And I wondered, as it was dripping into me at first, was it African blood I was receiving? Was it European blood? Did one make me more black? Did one make me more white? Of course, all that really mattered was that the blood types matched and that the person who donated the blood had helped me stay alive. And so surviving that brush with death allowed me to sort of shed immediately, sort of stepping out of the hospital, any vestige of anxiety about how people might perceive my racial identity or, between quotes, my blood. I just didn't worry about it anymore. So it helped me move into adulthood more confidently with a quieter, more assured, confident sense of identity. And often I think having a rooted sense of your identity, your ancestry, helps you step into the world and do good things, you know, be involved with others, love, give, travel, understand other cultures. So being rooted in who you are helps a great deal. So my brush with death and those transfusions really shook me up and sort of helped me drop an obsession and move, you know, more confidently into adulthood.
I was really surprised to read that up into the mid-20th century, donor blood was separated by race. I had no idea.
Yes. Well, you know, I didn't know that either until I researched this book. And funny, because I spent my life writing about issues of black and African-Canadian, African-American identity. This has been the sort of the center point of my own investigations as a novelist and journalist and essayist. But I hadn't known either until researching blood that during the Second World War, of course, there was this prominent African-American doctor named Charles Drew, who was a very light-skinned black man, who was the head of surgery at Howard University, and who was a leading expert in plasma in the world. And when the United States entered the war, the rules were passed prohibiting blacks from donating blood to whites. Initially, they weren't allowed to donate at all. And then, of course, the rules modified and it made it impossible for blacks to donate to whites. Bags of blood were to be marked W for white or C for colored. And so just as people were segregated during the war, my father, for example, was an African-American soldier in the American forces in the war. Just as people were segregated in the war, so was their blood. I hadn't known that. And this provoked an outcry from African-Americans who were deeply offended and hurt by these rules. And everybody knew, even at the time, even in 1941-42, it was fully understood that there was no biological difference between a black donor and a white donor of blood. The only thing that mattered in terms of blood safety was whether the blood types matched, and of course whether the blood was free of disease. but the race of the donor didn't bear into the equation. We knew that in 41, 42, but we still introduced these rules, which had nothing to do with science or medicine, but everything to do with social prejudice in the politics of the day. And so often politics and social prejudices have influenced blood donation policies, even completely disregarding the dictates of medicine and science.
And of course, this harkens back to the shameful tradition in the United States of the one drop rule, which essentially said that if you had even the most distant black ancestor, that you could never be considered anything other than black, which amounted to the fact that you didn't have rights.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, let's just look to the institution of slavery, which, of course, you know, was rooted in Canada as well as in the United States and many other parts of the world. But here in North America, you know, let's say your father was a white plantation owner who raped your mother, who was a black woman, a slave. Nobody stops to ask who happens to be your father. If you're known to have any black ancestry, let's say in this case your mother being black and being enslaved, you're going to be designated as black too. There's no concern for mixtures. Any drop of black blood will define you as being black, and nothing will sort of quote-unquote permit entrance to the white race except purely white blood. And this really does come down to notions of blood, and laws are passed, you know, making references to black and white blood and segregation. It all comes down to blood in our most kind of pernicious and dangerous thinking. And it's not just having to do with slavery in the United States and Canada, but it also has to do with equally dangerous phenomena such as genocide and people who kill others en masse. Generally, over the centuries, have drawn upon notions of the impurity of victims to justify their killing, the impurity of their blood. That goes back to the Spanish Inquisition and to the Holocaust, but even more modern times, to the Rwandan genocide. We always tend to taint the blood of our victims as being impure in order to justify mass murder.
You refer here as well to the story of Thomas Jefferson, who is such a fascinating character in history. And he had children with his white wife. He also had a number of children with his black mistress. The children that he had by his white wife were raised as his children. And the children that were sons and daughters of Sally Hemings were raised as Jefferson's slaves.
That's right. And of course, that's true of Jefferson, and it's particularly striking because he was an American president and a very famous and revered person. But this is basically a phenomenon that percolates down through pretty well every strata of plantation economies. It's not as if Jefferson were the only one. It's just that he's probably the most famous slave owner to, on one hand, own slaves, and on the other hand, to father others and to call them slaves. And really, there was a long-term debate, and for a long time, of course, you know, it was vigorously denied by, you know, society, by sort of major proponents of conservative thinking in the United States that this was true. But indeed, the DNA testing has pretty well proven that Jefferson did father several children by Sally Hemings, his black slave, and of course, having any ounce of black blood, so to speak, was enough to make those children slaves.
Well, let's talk about DNA, because it would seem that if any technology, any discovery in science would allow us to unlock ourselves from the things, the mythology that we've believed about blood, it would be DNA. And yet it doesn't seem to have erased a lot, even though DNA testing now reveals that a great number of us are of mixed race ancestry, if you go back far enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on DNA science, and I'm not a geneticist, and so I'm not the person to give an extremely, you know, elaborate scientific answer. But my sense of it from reading various books and articles and preparing the lectures in the book, Blood, the Stuff of Life, is that the DNA ancestry testing is still a matter of subjective evaluation, and a person who sort of has their you know, saliva tested for DNA samples and is looking for ancestral results might get different results depending on who one goes to. One company might offer one set of interpretations, and another company might offer quite another. So it seems to be a science that's evolving, but that's natural. It's not an old science, and people have only begun having their DNA tested for ancestral investigations over the last 10 or so years. It's fairly recent. But what's interesting, I think, is that when you do start testing for, you know, different sources of your ancestry, it becomes evident how mixed up almost all of us are, and it becomes almost impossible to maintain the lie or the myth that one is, quote-unquote, pure-blooded, or one is only one thing and not the others. And, you know, DNA ancestry testing, if anything, will continue to emphasize the truth of the matter, and that is how much human beings have moved around and have migrated and have intermarried and have had children, you know, from various ethnic or racial, you know, or geographic groups. And it's becoming harder and harder, I think, with DNA ancestry testing to maintain the fiction that one can be pure and not tainted or ruined by any stain of any other race or group. So in that sense, I think it's good, and it might help disturb notions of blood purity and of race.
Why do you think there are so many people invested in hanging on to those ideas of racial purity or impurity? I suppose the people who hang on to those ideas are the ones who appear to benefit from it.
Absolutely. And I mean, my understanding, again, I'm just one thinker and novelist turned essayist for the purposes of this book, is that race and racial identity is entirely a social construction. There's not a biological definition of race. There's, you know, you can't analyze a black person and come up with a distinct biological profile from the white person who's standing beside them or the Chinese person who's standing beside them. Race, for them, there are as many variations genetically between people of the same race, so to speak, as there are between people of different races. So, race is a social construct. It's something that we human beings have invented in order to create hierarchies, in order to have one set of people benefit over another and assume power and control. So it's something that we have invented and created. Perhaps those who are most loath to give it up are those who most benefit from the propagation of that hierarchy.
All right, let's talk about blood and crime. I think everyone's mind can go pretty easily to, you know, the bloody crime scene, the evidence that might be found. But now we have found that blood can be used specifically to commit crimes, as in the case of somebody like Lance Armstrong.
Oh, that's such an interesting question. And what's interesting to me about Lance Armstrong, and we should emphasize, most or a huge number of the elite athletes who were winning, say, the Tour de France or placing on the podium of the top three over the last many years, many others of his contemporaries also were doping and cheating. Many of them have been caught or stained by doping or cheating scandals as well. But basically, although he denied it, you know, for years and years and years, and long after the time that he won his seventh, you know, consecutive Tour de France, Armstrong played with his blood. And there's in the world of long distance sport, marathoning or triathlons or cycling or cross-country skiing, there's probably no more efficient way to cheat than to dope up your blood. You take your blood out, you store it, refrigerate it, preserve it, and then you retransfuse it into your body shortly before an important race. And what this does is apparently inject an excessive number of red blood cells into your system. And, of course, red blood cells are the ones that carry your oxygen, deliver that oxygen to your starving muscles when you're racing a bike up a mountain. And so it really does confer a significant advantage over your rivals if you're at least keeps you in the running, so to speak, if you're cheating with your blood. And this is precisely what Armstrong did. And I think one of the reasons why we're so scandalized by it, why we're so affected, I mean, why should we care so much that a guy racing up and down a mountain is cheating? We do care. And I think blood symbolizes for us honesty, morality, decency. Blood is what we give to keep each other alive. And so then Armstrong cheated with his blood and forced his teammates to do the same, forced his lieutenants, people who were there to help him win, to also cheat if they wanted to be on his team. I think this scandalizes us to our very core because he's using something we consider sacred, blood, and he's using that to cheat. And that really affects people.
Hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting because thinking about this as, you know, you're also considering issues of race and racial privilege, there is a parallel there. You know, it's like he did it because he could do it and could get away with it. And, you know, the fact that certain people benefited caused everyone to feel that they had to exploit, or I shouldn't say everyone, but a number of people to feel that they had to exploit this ability to benefit from this.
Yes, it's very interesting. One of his chief aides and one of his competitors later, person who raced with him and supported him for a long time, Tyler Hamilton, writes in great detail, with great honesty, he implicates himself. He doesn't just criticize Armstrong. He says, this is what we did, this is what I did. And even though we were cheating with our blood and taking it out and storing it and preserving it and then retransfusing it, sometimes at the top of a mountain after a stage of the race, while all the other testing officials and police officers and were passing by in their vehicles and journalists, they'd be lying down on the floor of a bus pretending to have a breakdown and getting blood transfusions from blood bags in a bus, you know, at the top of a mountain in France. And I think the athletes were governed by a thinking that they knew, of course, they were cheating, and if they were caught, they'd be thrown out. But they didn't really feel that they were cheating because they felt that all the other elite athletes who were likely to win or come close to winning were cheating too. And so they didn't really feel that they were cheating because they felt that it was rampant among all of their cronies. So they felt that if everybody else is doing it, well, we should do it too. This is what Tyler Hamilton said to be the case in terms of their thinking. So I guess it's easy to excuse yourself from cheating if you feel that others are doing the very same thing.
We often speak about talent being in your blood, and this is something that's been an issue within your own family in different capacities.
Yes, well, my brother was a famous singer-songwriter by the name of Dan Hill, who wrote a big hit back in the 70s called Sometimes When We Touch and many other songs. My father was a very well-known human rights activist in Canada who was well-known for his work in that field. His name was also Daniel Hill, and so like many other people who have sort of famous siblings or fathers, one sort of quickly hears as a child and as a teenager the expectation that you too will succeed in this area, perhaps music or perhaps human rights activism, because it's in your blood. Not necessarily because you're good at it or because you've worked very, very hard or studied like crazy or just killed yourself to become a great musician, but because it's in your blood. As if you have some sort of divine right to lead a country, you know, if you're part of a dynasty of leaders of the same family, or to be a great musician or artist or a public figure, people sort of assume that these things are in your blood, which is very troubling. Well, what if you're a sibling or a son or a daughter who's not inclined that way? Do you have to be inclined that way? What if you're not? Or what if you try to play the piano because your mother or father was a great pianist and you find out that you're really quite lousy and never going to be good? Are you a disappointment to your family because your blood, you didn't live up to the dictates of your blood? I think it's a very narrow way of thinking.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. My guest is Lawrence Hill, author of the new book, Blood, The Stuff of Life. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with author Lawrence Hill about his new book, Blood, The Stuff of Life. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You can also tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So you were saying before the break, Lawrence, that, you know, saying that something is in one's blood sort of devalues the contributions on both sides of something, the person who has worked very hard and then the person who may or may not share the same talent. And I suppose it can go the other way as well. You know, if you're related to someone who's a complete scoundrel, there could be really negative associations from sharing the same blood with that person.
People who have tried to escape, you know, that negative association, whether it's you're the child or the son or the daughter of a scoundrel, and you try to escape, move into another world where you won't be known, where that association will not be detected. Or perhaps you're born into a so-called race or religion that's at a severe disadvantage. Perhaps you're born a Jew during the Holocaust, or you're born black during a time of slavery, and you may try to find a way to escape your heritage, to slip into another, to acquire a false identity in order to stay alive. Perhaps you can pretend to the world that you're not a Jew, but you're an Aryan, and thereby escape an extermination camp during the Holocaust, or perhaps if you're light-skinned enough and fortunate and devious enough, you can find a way to pass for white during the time of slavery and escape, you know, the chains that hold you to a place. So many people have successfully sort of shaken off one identity, whether it's to avoid a family, you know, reputation that's bad, or whether it's to avoid, you know, slavery or genocide, and acquired another identity, slipped into another identity, often for years or perhaps for a whole lifetime, in order to be free.
We have a tweet here that asks, if you looked into the way that in Japan blood type is used for purposes of hiring and sort of socially evaluating different people based on associations that are made between different blood types and different personality traits.
That's very interesting. I have heard that in certain Asian countries, you know, Korea, Japan, certain associations are commonly made between blood type and personality. I think that's quite fascinating that you know, if you had a certain blood type, you might be inclined to be a certain way, or so the thinking goes. I haven't looked into it in depth, but I certainly read a little bit about it while I was researching the book and the essays, but I didn't write about it, as it didn't become a central preoccupation of mine. But it is quite interesting, isn't it, that we'd make associations between literal blood type and personality.
You mentioned earlier that you have to check your blood a few times a day to keep your diabetes under control. And I know that you looked for the book into the sort of physical properties of blood. I mean, were there particular facts about what it does for us and how it functions that really struck you even as you got deep into this research?
Well, blood really is quite a miraculous substance, isn't it? I mean, for one thing, just the way it flows in your veins, and you can lose it quite quickly, quite accidentally. I mean, you don't normally walk around at risk of, say, losing your liver, you know, or your kidney, like, popping out of your body and rolling down the sidewalk, and you die because your kidney just kind of fell out of your body, or, you know, or a foot or a hand isn't just going to fall off. But blood, you know, with the slightest provocation, you know, a needle or a knife or something, you know, that wouldn't be normally able to take out a whole organ or a whole piece of your body, might be enough to lead you to bleed to death. So you can have it, yet on the other hand, you can lose it quite easily. And you can lose a lot of it, amazingly, and then not die. You could lose as much as 40% of your blood and still live if you didn't lose it too quickly. And then, of course, if you got AIDS. And the other thing, of course, about blood that's miraculous is that you can be given it, and you can give it many, many times over without even hurting yourself. Your health isn't even damaged if you take your own blood out, you know, in order to give it to other people. So we can give it, you know, we can take it, we can give it to each other, we can lose it, we can lose a fair amount of it. But the properties of blood are also quite interesting. All the different ways that cells work, the way plasma is like a river in the body carrying all the blood parts, and the white blood cells are sort of thought of as soldiers battling infection. They sort of have military terminology. There's so many different ways to think about the blood parts.
What kind of vampire literature did you look at just to fully educate yourself for this project?
Well, I reread Dracula, of course, and I looked at a little bit of the Twilight series by Stephanie Meyer, but I just couldn't stomach it. but I was quite interested, and it's funny when you think about it. Like, I have five children, and you know, let's see, one, two, three of them, you know, are still teenagers, and you know, I defy you to find me one typical 15-year-old North American girl these days who's not absolutely obsessed with vampire culture. And how is it that just about every popular book and TV show has something to do with blood and the spilling of blood and vampires? And like the Harry Potter series, of course, is not about vampires but about wizards. And the Stephanie Meyer series, you know, Twilight, is about vampires, but both. And these are by far the most influential children's books to have been published probably in a century, are obsessed with notions of blood purity. Hmm. And the central struggle in the 7-part Harry Potter series is whether Lord Voldemort, the evil antagonist, will succeed in exterminating wizards who have impure blood, half-blood, mixed-blood wizards. Really, Harry Potter can be read as an allegory having to do with the Holocaust, and it's very interesting to think that children who read these books, millions and millions, are steeped for weeks, you know, in notions of blood purity.
I wonder, you know, the point at which this occurs to them, unless someone points it out.
Well, I think that, you know, any child who's smart enough to read the Harry Potter series, it's a lot of pages. That's 7 books, and they're difficult, demanding books, with great imagination. you know, you have to be a pretty good child reader to read the Harry Potter series. And I think any child who's capable of reading them is capable of recognizing that the fundamental struggle does have to do with blood purity. It's not hidden, or it's not some great difficult subtle observation. It's a central preoccupation in the books.
And then, of course, the vampire books. There is it's pretty clearly they're pretty clearly explorations of sexuality and metaphors related to that.
Yes, and I find those a little more troubling. I mean, in the Twilight series, you know, blood is like there's notions of purity associated with virginity. And then there's, of course, notions of purity with regard to human blood versus that of the blood of a vampire. Are you going to be bitten or loved by a vampire and then be brought over to the dark side? So will your blood become impure because you transform yourself, or you are transformed into being a vampire? Or, you know, are you pure? Are you virginal? And so those ideas are, in my ways, a little more regressive and less interesting, but they're still dominant and still something that seems to affect, you know, well, millions of readers. So it's very interesting that vampire culture on TV shows, movies, books is so universal these days.
So are you careful now about how you refer to your own blood when you talk to your children or to their blood? I mean, do you say something like, you know, every red-blooded Canadian does this, this, and this, or is it something that you wouldn't maybe cavalierly throw around anymore?
Well, I think that, I mean, some metaphors are perfectly innocent, and they don't leave me too disturbed. So if somebody says, you know, every red-blooded American, you know, or Canadian truly hopes to find peace in the world or whatever, well, I'm not going to be all up in arms about that. There are beautiful ways to imagine blood as a metaphor that aren't negative at all. If you love your family and you love the idea of your own cultural ancestry, and that sort of forms a quiet, quaint print metaphor of blood in your mind, and you imagine the blood of your family to represent identity, and that helps you feel good about yourself, that's great. I have no quibble with that. I feel those ways myself. But if you're employing blood as a metaphor to hurt other people, leading a genocide, or telling somebody that they can or can't be, you know, an American native, or they are not African American or African Canadian, they will or they will not be enslaved or segregated, then we move into difficult or dangerous zones. So I guess it all depends on how we're employing metaphors, for the good or for the worse.
It is interesting that we seem to continue to struggle with allowing individuals to define their own identities for themselves. We sort of feel that as a society, we have the right to tell them, you are black, you are white, you are Latino, you are something else, rather than having them make that declaration for themselves. And I remember when President Obama first came on the scene as Senator Obama, there were sort of questions about his right to sort of declare himself as a black man.
Well, that's very interesting, and that question is so, it says so much about where we are. On one hand, perhaps some people did feel that they would want to question Obama's right to call himself a black man, and perhaps that might have been coming from some quarters of you know, African-American society where that was challenged. On the other hand, you and I, I'm sure, both know that there's virtually no possibility that Obama, as a young man in the United States, could have successfully called himself white. That was not an option. As we discussed earlier, if you're known to have black ancestry, even just some, or a small part of your ancestry is black, you can't walk around and call yourself white. Not in the United States and not in Canada. It just doesn't wash. It won't work, not even today. And so he really, I don't think, had much choice but to identify positively as an African American, because that was the only identity that was really viable for him. And so, but you do get it from both sides. You know, some might say, you know, well, why can't you call yourself white? But I think that's naive. It doesn't reflect the political realities of today. And some might question his authenticity as a black person, which is equally horrifying, in my opinion. You know, your authenticity as an African American or African Canadian is not to be measured in your blood parts or in the tone of your skin. You either have African ancestry or you don't, and that's not measured out with blood parts.
And I guess there's also the question of the difference between ancestry and culture, and they are not necessarily one and the same.
Well, that's absolutely true. You may have certain ancestry but not be steeped in any way in the culture. Let's say you were, in the extreme case, given up for adoption when you're an infant, you may have ancestry that you're not even aware of. You likely will have ancestry you're not aware of unless you're able to research it later. And you may be steeped or raised in a culture entirely other than that of your ancestors. So that would be an obvious example on the extreme end of culture not being the same as ancestry, for sure. But other people may have, many of us do, let's face it, have multiple ancestries, but we don't necessarily practice them all, or we don't necessarily, I should say, we don't necessarily practice the cultures or the traditional cultures of all those ancestries. Some of those cultures may be privileged or favored in our daily practices, and others might be completely ignored.
For Americans who maybe are not familiar with the Massey Lectures, can you explain what they are and how they're how speakers are chosen each year?
Oh, it's such a privilege. The Massey Lectures have been going on for over 50 years in Canada, and that's sort of a prominent citizen sometimes of the world. It could be somebody like Martin Luther King, who was a Massey lecturer many decades ago, or it could be a prominent Canadian intellectual such as Northrop Frye or Margaret Atwood, is invited to write a book on a subject that they find quite passionate. I chose blood. Blood is a metaphor for identity. And then after writing this book, a short book of usually five chapters, a nonfiction book, a set of essays, one delivers these essays all across Canada, which are then broadcast on national radio in Canada and usually in Australia as well. So it's really a lovely speaking gig, probably the most wonderful speaking gig in Canada. So I was really quite honored to be invited to be the 2013 Massey Lecturer.
Have you been happy with the kinds of conversations that these lectures have sparked?
I have been. And one thing that I'm quite interested in are, not only did we discriminate against blacks in the time of the Second World War by saying that they couldn't donate blood if they were known to be African Americans, but that policy didn't really adhere to scientific principles. But today, blood donors in Canada and the States and most other rich and developed nations are not allowed to donate their blood if they're known to be gay males who are sexually active who are having sex with other men. And that too is a policy that's completely outdated and doesn't really bear, reflect the dictates of science and medicine. It's far too broad a brush to use to say who gets to donate and who doesn't these days, especially with very sophisticated blood testing technology and interviewing techniques. We can determine whether an individual donor is a safe donor or not, make sure the blood supply is still safe without saying an entire group of people can't donate just because of their sexual orientation. So that's another example of sort of social fears overtaking or hijacking science and medicine.
Do you find that having worked on this, you still maintain your obsession with blood, or has this project helped you to sort of set it aside a little bit?
I say playfully I have an obsession with blood. I don't think I'm truly wandering around all day long obsessed about it. I do have to measure my own blood sugar levels several times a day, especially before and after exercise and before and after eating, because I have diabetes, so I have to know what's going on with my blood sugars. But mostly, as I said earlier, I'm interested in it as a metaphor. And those obsessions wax and wane according to, my writing inclinations.
The new book by author Lawrence Hill is called Blood, The Stuff of Life. Lawrence, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you. I'm delighted to join you, Chris.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had production assistance today from Christina Martinez, and Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is sponsored in part by the Horchow family, celebrating the vast array of ideas heard each day on KERA.